This is Nathan Schwartz-Salant, November 18th, 1989, Alchemy, Borderline States, tape 3 of 3.
The Neo Geo happens, the attack on what on whatever containment you have happens, so new material goes on. Does it ever reach a level of perfection? Of course not. Is that a reasonable goal? Yeah. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with having a true moral fiber that wants to integrate all of our psychopathy and all of our ruthlessness. There's nothing wrong with that. That's important. But that would be the third level. That's the attempt that they attempt to reach. So this is the kind of qualitative position that goes on in alchemy. Yeah?
One question. If this is going to take you too far off, I don't mind you. The notion of Winnicott's theory, one of the problems I've had with that is it does seem to reduce most of the negative activity in the psychological sphere. It doesn't make room for the strength of darkness.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Even Masoud Khan, who was Winnicott's devotee, said that Winnicott had far too positive a nature notion of the self. Absolutely. Yeah.
Could you operationalize a little bit the when the depressive position then moves again back into the paranoid state?
Yeah. What happens is, again, one then meets states of ruthlessness, states of splitting, which are not ever as intense necessarily, only as intense as the previous position. One has, as I showed, I don't know if you were in my lecture last night, but as one gets through the depressive position and then moves backwards, one generally has done it in a way where there's less schizoid withdrawal. It doesn't mean that you won't meet more demonic influences than you met before. You know, it doesn't mean that more of the devil might not be there, that more paranoia, that more distrust. In fact, it will be. And you'll hit eventually levels that Michael Bowland called the basic fault, where one cannot trust. But in the process, you'll meet them without the schizoid withdrawal that previously was there, which makes it impossible to have them in a process. Now, you know, the eros is going to go in one place, and there's not going to be enough of it to go elsewhere. There's a loss, there's a shadow, there's a darkness. You know, it's not to be judged, it's a fact. Now, I also then want to now go to another alchemical treatise to you, with you. It's now 3:15. Do you want a break? No? Would you stand up and stretch? In secret. And after staying there a long time, I wished to come back. Well, when I was about to leave, one of the prophets or angels who dwell in the first firmament caught sight of me. He advanced towards me and wanted to mate with me in the intercourse of love. But I refused to yield. I demanded first from him that he should tell me of the preparation of gold and silver. He, however, exhibited a certain sign that he had on his head, and a vase that had not been coated with pitch, filled with transparent water, which he held between his hands. But he refused to tell me the truth. Next day, having returned towards me, Amnael, another angel, Amnael was seized with desire on my account and unable to contain his impatience. The word's great. He hastened to achieve the object for which he had come. But as for me, I deliberately took no notice. We're talking about not looking at the erotic material. I deliberately took no notice. And I did not ask him about those things. He, however, did not stop from trying to win me over and to invite me to the business. But I refused to let him take me. I triumphed over his lust till he was ready to show me the sign on his head and reveal to me, generously and without hiding anything, the sought-for mystery. So he decided then to show me the sign and reveal the mysteries. He began by detailing the warnings and the oaths, and this is how he phrased it. I adjure you by heaven and earth, light and darkness. I adjure you by fire, water, air, and earth. I adjure you by the heights of the heaven and the depths of Tartarus. I adjure you by Hermes and Anubis, and by the roaring of the serpent Ouroboros and the three-headed dog Cerberus, guardian of Hades. I adjure you by the three goddesses of fate, by their whips and by their sword. When he had made me swear by all these words, he went on to enjoin me that I must never communicate the revelation to anyone except you, my beloved and legitimate son. Get this, and I'll go back to it. My beloved and legitimate son, so that he might be you and you he. So go then, my child, to a certain laborer, Ahab, and ask him what he has sown and what he has harvested. And you will learn from him that the man who sows wheat also harvests wheat, and the man who sows barley harvests also barley. Now that you've heard this discourse, my child, learn to comprehend the whole fabrication and generation of these things, and know that it is the condition of a man to sow a man, of a lion, of a dog. And if it happens that one of these things is produced against the order of nature, he has engendered in the state of a monster and cannot subsist. And she adds here Austin's formula, for a nature rejoices another nature, and a nature conquers another nature. So then, having shared in this divine power and been favored with this divine presence, illuminated in turn as a result of Isis's demand, this, now the alchemist is talking, we must prepare the matter with the aid of minerals alone without using other substances, and attain our goal by the fact that matter added was of the same nature as that which was prepared. Just as I have told you, wheat engenders wheat, man engenders man, and similarly gold engenders gold. See, there is the whole of the mystery. So there you have another text which again claims to represent the whole of the alchemical mystery. You make a dog from a dog, a cat from a cat. I say to you that in the course of psychotherapy, 9/10 of the time we're making cats from dogs, and we're making dogs from cats. Any time you're with a patient and you do not simply stay with the intensity and depth of feeling evoked, the intense states of despair, confusion, chaos, rage, whatever, states of mind that you will have a normal tendency naturally to split with, that I have a normal tendency to split with, whenever we don't stay with those states and work from those states, in which case we would have a chance to formulate things as a nature delights in another nature, when we don't stay with those states but instead get out of them and say something, comment, interpret, whatever, when we don't just stay with the matter at hand, we make a dog from a cat. I'll give you an example, a funny one. A therapist told me that he was dealing with this extremely difficult patient. And before she started therapy with him, she told him that she couldn't stand anything having to do with bathrooms. Now, this guy had his bathroom in his waiting room. Not a good place for the bathroom. This guy had his bathroom in his waiting room. And every time he'd have her as a patient, he didn't want to use the bathroom first. So he saw her for about a year, never using the bathroom, and feeling pretty uncomfortable most of the time during sessions with her. See? Here he was, consequently, in a state where he had a certain nature that was calling, and he wouldn't deal with that nature. He pushed it aside. Instead, that's really not dealing with nature, you see. So she would come in, and he would deal with her, he would talk to her. So finally, when he brought this to supervision, I explained to him that he had to go to the bathroom. So the next time he saw her, indeed, he went to the bathroom first. And when he went into the session with her, she said, "You know, today you seem human for the first time." A slightly, you know, more common kind of circumstance. Therapist complains about how difficult this woman patient is. She brings a dream to him, and in a dream, she dreams that she's in a room, there's some unknown male around who refuses to listen to her. She doesn't know who the man is. She doesn't have any associations to him. She then goes on in the session and talks about how she, in fact, feels so unlistened to by people in her environment, by your family, by whatnot. What does he say? He says, "Of course, I can understand that, you know, given how awful your upbringing was. I can understand how that's such a sensitive issue and how you're so tuned in to not being heard." See, he made a dog from a cat. He did not realize that she's talking to him, that her dream is talking about the fact that what's going on with them is he's not listening to her. If he would have stayed with that state of mind, seen the communication, seeing that she in fact feels not listened to, furthermore finds where she is correct and in fact is not being listened to, then they have a chance to make a dog from a dog, a man from a man, a lion from a lion. It's this tendency to substitute, to sidestep, to not deal with what the patient is really presenting, but to take it on ever so slightly or not so slightly a different level that produces the monstrosity in psychotherapy. We all do it. It's impossible to avoid because we can never really penetrate and deal on all the levels that are being communicated at once. So it's a big problem. But you can take it as a wonderful axiom, as a wonderful metaphor. Make a dog from a dog. Don't make a dog from a cat. That means you must stay primarily with your body reactions and with your real feelings. A man comes to me, works with me for many years. Interesting guy, finishing his doctorate, ready to go out in the world, and says to me that he's afraid he's going to fail. Terribly afraid he's going to fail in the world. Talks to me about his relationships with his wife, about how he's totally immersed in his work, and about how he doesn't relate to her. All the while, I know in my head, in my feeling, that I'm not making a really good contact with him. So I try to make a contact. And I talk to him about what's going on in him that's leading him to feel this way. I talk to him about his inflation, which is leading in turn to these terribly deflated fantasies. That was a smart interpretation. It was right. I talk to him about his state of being like Narcissus at the pool, totally engaged in a terribly immersed relationship with his creative work in too much of a narcissistic fusion, and that he has to break that or else he suffers the fate of Narcissus, where he is attacked viciously by internal envy and feels everything's going to get spoiled. And so he better give his attention to his wife, just like in 12th century writings in the Romance of the Rose. You can read people talking about, I remember that woman now who passed me by, and I don't want to have the same fate as Narcissus, and I better hasten from this pool and go after her. Could talk on this level of the dangers of this, and he could take it in, and it could all be right. And he could tell me that it's fine, it's right, but he says, I'm still paranoid. He says, I still believe that the world out there is not going to hear me, that what I have to offer is really not going to be wanted. And I try more, giving him answers. Interesting ones, too. You know, clever. And he has the courage, you see, to come back and say, I was bored upon coming here. I don't know why, but something's still not right. Until finally, he, in his courage, could get me to realize that if I'm really open and honest with him, I feel depersonalized. I feel not myself. I don't know who I am, but I don't feel like myself. I could take it in terms of being filled by his father in projective identification. By this time, fortunately, I wasn't going to do that to him. Even though, of course, it also was right. It also was right, you see. The projective identification that was going on was also there. But the fact was that, in fact, I could not feel connected to him. I could not feel a contact. I felt a depersonalized situation. I didn't know what to do. That was the state I had to work with and tell him about. You see? And then he could acknowledge that and for once feel an honest air between us. And then also, we could both acknowledge that we didn't know what to do, that it was a time where the doing of that which was to be done was still in a state of confusion, which was still asleep. And we could both realize that we were dealing with a level far beyond anything we had dealt with before, and wait to see what might emerge. But until that point, I had made a bunch of dogs out of cats. All very connected, all quite clever, all useful, even useful, and all monstrosities. Because they all were power-driven, distorted, contorted ways of making a connection with him. Every time you force a connection where there is no connection, you make a dog out of a cat. Every time you're with a patient and you don't pay attention to your discomfort, you make a dog from a cat. Every time you run over your feelings of disquiet, whatever they may be, you do the same thing. You violate the basic axiom of alchemy. And what does Isis say now? Isis says, my son, when you were fighting with your arch enemy Set, you know the battle of Horus and Set in alchemy in Egypt, Egyptian mythology. That's the crucial battle. That's called the Battle of the Two Fellows, in which Horus tears out Seth's testicles, and Seth tears out Horus's eye. That battle rages all the time and has to be subdued finally in order that there be peace between the two lands in Egypt, Upper and Lower Egypt. She says, while you were fighting with Set, I went to Hermopolis. This is already very interesting. The battle between Horus and Set is the battles that we frequently have with our patients. I don't mean the overt battles, but I mean the battles having to do with one tearing out the testicles of the other and one tearing out the eye of the other. The battles in which we unconsciously or consciously tend to be castrating of the other person and the other attacking of our vision. The battles that really dominate fields of projective identification, where one puts something into the other person. Intense fields of sadomasochism. That can be the centerpiece of analytic work. Here it's a background. Isis gets beyond it. She goes to something deeper. She goes to gain a mystery. She goes to really gain the mystery. When you're involved in the battle between Horus and Set, when you're involved on that level, and you either take Set's position or Horus's position, you're involved in a power struggle with your patient. You're involved in perhaps a sophisticated one, in which you're using projective identification, parts put into you to interpret what's happening to the patient. You're still making dogs from cats in that way of thinking. She goes on to get the mystery from the angel. How does she get it? She gets it by being able to resist the desire. She resists acting out desire. Desire is the door, the key. Without desire, there's no door to the phenomenon. Desire's got a bad name in Jungian psychology. You have to read Lacan to appreciate the beauty and importance of desire. And Freud, the importance of desire. But the desire is not acted on, it's in fact sacrificed, it's held back. So a level of desire is contacted between her and the angel. That desire could take numerous forms. It could be the passion to interpret. It could be the passion to know. It could be the desire for another person. It could be the passion for another person's knowledge, for another person's energy, for another person's body, mind, whatever you will. But it's that level of desire that's contacted and sacrificed. And what she meets is this angel who has this vessel on his head, and it's not covered in pitch, and it's clear. So you get the idea that the vessel is the mystery. And as it goes on, and through inhibition and frustration of desire, she gets to that point where it said, I must never communicate the revelation to anyone except you, my beloved and legitimate son, so that he might be you and you he. In a paper I wrote on projective identification, and for those of you who are interested, you can read that in the chapter in my book on the borderline personality in chapter 4 on projective identification. There comes a point where one transcends projective identification. The story that alludes to this is one I used in that book without knowing this. It comes from Ibn Arabi in Sufism. And it talks about a seeker who goes to heaven and knocks on the door. And someone behind the door answers and says, who is it? And the seeker says, it is I. And the voice says, go away for a year. So he goes away for a year, and he meditates, and he comes back and he knocks on the door. And the voice says, who is it? And the seeker says, it is you. And then he's allowed to enter. See, this fundamental mystery of sameness. The fundamental mystery of sameness. Not difference, but sameness. And then he can enter. And so what in fact comes out of this is that the vessel is in fact the secret that you make a dog from a dog, a cat from a cat. That when you can follow that axiom and not depart from it, you in turn create a vessel, have a vessel that can contain the analytic process. A vessel that's the same as its contents. That's the secret of the analytic vessel. That's what the alchemists call the aqua permanens. The container is the same as the contents contained. It's not an abstract concept. It's not a view of individuation. It's not a developmental process. It's a symbol. The container's the great mystery. It's the grail. It's the golden breast of Isis in Egyptian mystery. One gets it in this seemingly bizarre way, which is almost like, you know, punchline to a bad joke. You make a dog from a dog, a cat from a cat. Yet that's the whole mystery. And in that way, one gets to the container. Now, these are all principles of alchemy that were formed early on up to the 3rd, 4th century. Now I'd like to go to an alchemical text from the 16th century, The Splendor Solace, and go through it to show you, albeit in brief form, we don't have time to do it in detail, how the alchemists of later times, the alchemists of the Renaissance, worked on their process. Early alchemy does not have so many pictures. At least if they exist, they don't seem to be known. What happened in the 16th century was there was a powerful symbolic movement in alchemy. It was led by the publication of the Rosarium Philosophorum, the Rosary of the Philosophers, first published in 1550. Its attributes go back to early personages, but nobody is sure. Some say Arnold of Villanova, perhaps back in the early 15th century. But what one knows is that a set of woodcuts created by a German fraternity came into existence. 20 woodcuts that were looked at and meditated on like a rosary, and hence were called the Rosary of the Philosophers. Later, a German text was added. Sometimes the text alludes to the picture, sometimes it doesn't. The text would include all these kind of principles like we've been talking about today. Sometimes it's hard to know how they apply. They go in and out. When the Rosarium came into existence, it opened up the field for a whole rash of new texts on alchemy. And the one after the Rosarium was the one I want to show you, is the Splendor Solace. Splendor Solace is allocated to a so-called Trismosin by name, which is a pseudonym. The Splendor Solace is usually dated around 1588, sometimes later, 1592. But it's 16th century alchemy. It's very similar to the Rosarium in its power. Rosarium is the most famous of the alchemical texts. Splendor Solace, perhaps the second most famous. I cannot go into an overall analysis of these texts with you. We don't have time. All I would like to say to you in preface is that the Rosarium primarily deals with the issue of the union between two people. It deals with states of union and their death and the formation of new structures. They deal, in a sense, strongly on a horizontal level, taking up a lot from tantric symbolism. The Splendor Solace, I believe, I have to put it that way, this is strictly my idea, okay, as far as I know, has to do with far more a vertical dimension of the incarnation of a spiritual archetypal existence into matter, into space-time form. I believe it took up and complemented the Rosarium. Now, what I think I should do is run through the pictures of the Rosarium with you so you can see them. Does everybody know them? Not some do. Since I've alluded to them, I don't want to not show them. But I will do them quickly, so please float with it. And then the Splendor Solace a little less quickly, so you can see how these principles we've been talking about, how these ideas were then communicated in images. So, can we turn the shades down, lights off? The Rosarium comes in many renditions. The Rosarium comes in many renditions. Some of them are colored, some of them are not colored. This one that I'm showing you here, you probably haven't seen before. It's all right. I'm going back. No, I'm just starting. I'm getting to the beginning. I mean, you didn't get all that? I just wanted to get to the first slide. This is from the Stadtbibliothek in St. Gallen. It's said to be the most beautiful rendition of the Rosarium. I have others, for example, from the University of Edinburgh Library. There are others that are just black and white. There's all different varieties of these. This is picture one of the Rosarium. It's the mercurial fountain. It has to do with the waters of the process. The alchemists talk about these waters as our chaos. The waters are said in other places to flood and to be that which has to be dealt with. There are lower waters, there are upper waters. The lower have a lot to do with erotic material, sexuality, what was left out by Christianity. Especially the lower waters attributed often to Dionysus. The upper has to do really with massive states of chaos, which has a lot to do with the conjunction. When Jung first published these in Zurich in 1946, he had to get them by the censor. They were thought of as pornographic, you see. This is the first union in Astaine's formula. Nature delights in nature. Now, as a result of what happens after this one's going to reach the next stage in Astaine's formula, nature overcomes nature. What happens then is always in alchemy, a death occurs. Now they're in a coffin. But in the process, a hermaphrodite has been formed. A hermaphrodite has been formed. In other words, if you're thinking in terms of an interactive field, a different kind of structure has happened where now there is a state of oneness that's imminent within the field. But it's still in a stage of death. In turn leading to the soul leaving, the so-called extraction of the soul, this is a state, if this kind of an image rules the interactive field between you and another person, you experience states of mind in which there are absolutely no linking between you. The soul is gone. It's a state that generally precludes empathy as a possibility. It's a state that precludes empathy. It's a very difficult state to get to get through and to get to. Excuse me, I really mean we're usually in it without knowing it and attempting to instead make dogs from cats. But it's a state that's very, very difficult to manage because there is no real linking possible. In psychotherapy, I think beyond any other virtue, one has to learn to be able to tolerate non-linking. Tolerate an absence of linking without judgment and also with judgment. That leads in turn to a wonderful Mundificatio, the falling dew. in which this body that was still filled with the sin of incest, meaning an interactive field was still existing in which there was still a tremendous tendency to acting out, for the ego is to identify with the field rather than allow it to have its own existence as a third entity, is cleansed further of those contaminations. In turn, the soul now returns to the body to enliven the pair, leading to the rebus or hermaphrodite of picture 10. This would correspond to a nature overcomes another nature. Here, what's talked about is a creature that stands on the moon. In alchemy, standing on the moon means overcoming death. That's to say, if you're with another person in this state, you're able to tolerate massive attacks on linking. You can tolerate abandonment threats. You can tolerate fears of loss without losing a sense of self and connection. That's the creation and the alchemical phase of the albedo, the white phase. It's still a psychic product. It lacks blood. It still is an important product, an incredibly important product. You know, the main major difference is when you're with someone and you can tolerate all kinds of massive states of depression, induced feelings of abandonment, withdrawal by you, without freaking out, without acting out, with being able instead to tolerate them as existing third things. That's what's achieved in that kind of a state. But one's not ready yet for that notion of a nature conquers another nature. The conquering hasn't happened yet because at this state, the two people together have not yet assimilated enough passion. The blood has not come into the process. And so it leads to the next stage of the rubedo, which then begins with picture 11, another conjunctio. This is something that takes a, I teach this to people. I have a course on alchemy that I teach, and we spend every night looking at one of these pictures. So we take an hour and a half per picture, sometimes 3 hours per picture. So because one really could and needs to get into it. But what's fascinating is in this picture, picture 11, called the fermentatio, now in this conjunction, the woman is on top. In picture 5, the first conjunction, the man was on top. If you are, say, a man with a woman, it's in this stage that you can really feel her yang power and you more yin. This state, when this is felt as an interactive field, the field has wings. You see, there's a lot of energy in it, and it can lead to feelings of out-of-the-body experience. You can begin to feel like a rising up right in the interactive space. It leads to another death. Here you have the solificatio. You have the sun going down into the lunar well. This, I think, has a lot to do with the sacrifice of solar life. What the alchemists are always talking about is sacrifice is death, is the willingness to sacrifice any illumination you've had for the sake of the ongoing process. The willingness to sacrifice all previous illuminations. One aspect of that can certainly be the sacrifice of interpretation, as we were talking about it. But the willingness of the sun to go down into the well of Luna. Once again, leading to a nigredo state, a death. Now, at this point, the death states are not so difficult to manage as they were in the previous 10. There's more wings, there's more spirit in the creatures, there is less acting out tendencies, there's more awareness of the up and down motion, there's been more purification of the interactive field, but still a death. Again, a soul loss. Now the soul is feminine, she has long hair. Previously, in the first time, the soul was masculine. In other words, what leaves here is a feminine quality of soul, a quality of linking that had a feminine nature to it. A mundificatio, a return of the soul, leading to the next picture of, again, nature overcomes nature. You see, it goes twice here. It goes twice here. A nature overcomes a nature again. This is another phase. This time, what this excuse me, what this represents, this is not the representative. What this represents is an overcoming of fusion states, a great overcoming of fusion states, a tremendous success, leading to one of the central pictures and most important pictures in alchemy, the green line devouring the sun. This stage is something that takes a lot of talk, and I just have to be brief with it. For those of you that heard my lecture yesterday, it has to do with the stage of the sun lover. It has to do with the capacity for, say, if you're a man, for you to be able to trust that you're not going to be devoured by a woman on an outer ego level, and be able to trust to let your consciousness down into that level of deep innate passion symbolized by the great goddess, and trust that you're not going to be destroyed. This is something that plagues every man. And the same issue goes on with a woman in terms of how she's going to deal with her own consciousness. And it goes on especially with women in a need for a woman to learn not to save a man. Women are always feeling this in a man. They're always feeling the dangers of the devouring negative aspect of the green lion, that part of his deep negative mother complex that would devour him and kill him the way Attis is killed by Cybele. Women are always, excuse the exaggerations, women are always sensing this and tending to be mothers, and tending to save the man, and tending to be on the alert to be helpers. That has to be sacrificed. That has to be given up. It leads to the coronation. The soul is now coronated. That's the assumption of Maria. But it happened 300 years before the papal announcement, you see, in alchemy. And that leads finally to the resurrected Christ. I am he who arises free of sin without spots. You see, so here would become like the last element of Ostein's formula, you know, nature overcomes nature. The final overcoming. But you see, that's how that qualitative logic flows through this remarkable set of pictures. I talk about these, the first 10 I talk about in my book on the borderline personality. I haven't published the last 10 yet, the libido phase, but will be. Now, any comment? I certainly have gone as fast as possible, but is there some comment before we go on? Certainly we could take a few minutes. Pardon me? Okay. The next is the series of the Splendor Solace. That's picture one of the Splendor Solace. Aren't they beautiful? You've seen them, haven't you? You know, you've seen them in if you look at alchemy books, you know, Thames and Hudson, or you know, popularized books here and there. A lot of the pictures that are usually pulled out are from the Splendor Solace. These come from the British Museum, which owns the in its so-called Harley manuscript these woodcuts of the Splendor Solace. In other words, they're woodcuts that have been colored, hand-colored, in the Harley manuscript. Now, the first one addresses the major issue of the Splendor Solace. I'm going to see if I can focus this any better. That's a little better. Addresses the major issue of the Splendor Solace, the incarnation of the sun into matter, the shield, the problem of the incarnation. How many of you have had experiences that you felt were illuminations, whether with drugs or not drugs, meditation or whatever, and they didn't come to much? Didn't come to much. How many of you have had a powerful experience that did not incarnate as an inner self? That's all of us. That did not come into being as a self. That's the issue that the Splendor Solace addresses. The process whereby the powerful experience does not simply remain a powerful experience, a thing of memory, but comes into embodied material life. Please notice the two alchemists there in the back. And they're talking about these waters. Everything in alchemy begins with the waters. In Egypt, the most central symbol is the water, the primeval waters. The waters in the beginning of which there's no separation between heaven and earth, no direction, no up, down, left, right, the waters of primeval chaos. These waters for these alchemists are moving to their left. So it's a little like engaging in the left-hand contact of the Rosarium. It's getting involved in waters which are extremely dangerous. To the alchemists here, they're like the River of Styx, whose waters cannot be contained by anything, save, as you know, in the Golden Ass, a horse's, the hoof of an ass. They are the waters which are so dissolving, meaning you meet these waters with a patient and you tend to lose structure. You tend to lose your structure, you tend to lose your boundaries, and you tend to act out either by virtue of acting on certain energies or by virtue of splitting and withdrawing. These are the powerful energies of chaos, out of which all begins. Chaos that we meet when we meet our psychotic parts. So the alchemist here is talking about the waters, and we know he's going to have to involve himself in these waters, but you see they're pretty hesitant. They're not so thrilled about doing it. But it's all in service of the incarnation. Sorry about that. Goes on to the next picture, and here is an alchemist who has succeeded in raising the four elements. Now what that means is he has succeeded in becoming a master of this process of the raising up of the bodily contents, the raising up of matter, meaning he has been able to feel deep, dark energies of all kinds and be able to have an imaginal process with them. The previous one is the descent. This one is now the ascent. These two pictures concern that ascent and descent we spoke about. The third picture is the one that I referred to about, it says on the shield, it says, for those of you who wish to create the sun and the moon, add the inimical wine to their mixture and obtain vision at their death. The pissing mannequins there, as they're called, one with the gold and one with the silver fluid, are children. The solar and lunar fluids represent the intense erotic life of infancy. Intense early erotic life, what Freud called infantile sexuality, which is really a kind of modern term for what in antiquity would have been called Dionysian energies. These are the energies of life that we've all been forced to one degree or another to sublimate, to push out of our existence, to repress. And here they're looked at as the actual prima materia that has to flow together, join together, the gold and the silver. But also they're related to the sun and the moon. They're related also to different kinds of vision, a solar vision, a lunar vision, and they're related also to an ascent to solar life, a descent down to lunar, more spontaneous life. These have to be combined. These natures have to be combined in both their instinctual level and their more cognitive, mental, spiritual level. And combined in a way where the knight there, you see, he has the four colors of alchemy on him, the black, yellow, red, you see, and white. Sometimes yellow is death in alchemy. Sometimes it's associated to illumination. It's an ambivalent color. He has the sword because that means he is somebody who will represent discrimination during this time. He can still have discrimination amidst the incredible pressure of these energies. That's another ingredient to the process. You see, ingredients are being pulled together. So you see the first three, and then that leads now to the fourth. Now that one is like, you might remember, in the Rosarium, the king and the queen meeting. Notice the look on the king's face.
You'll have to describe it.
Oh, too bad. The look on the king's face, it's one of kind of horror and surprise. He suddenly has come across the queen. He's come across her, and he's like shocked. Because he knows he is suddenly entering into this dangerous arena of incest. This dangerous arena of dealing with energies that have been split off by generations of repression. Not just the human levels we know from childhood, but those energies that may have once thrived in mystery cults and then were driven under by the patriarchy. He knows he's coming in touch with those energies, and he has this horror about it. Now, I say to you that this represents a process in which, as you can later see, and will later see, these energies of passion and incest are not engaged so directly as they are in the Rosarium. They are left to be kind of background, because instead, the emphasis is on a warming, brooding heat that comes from one person to another, say. There's a commentary that goes with the Splendor Solace, as there are commentaries that go with the Rosarium. The commentary says that what creates this process, what helps it move, is not the union of the red and the white. Not that power, although that's necessary, but what helps it move is the heat, the brooding heat of like the hen on her egg. It's a very interesting differentiation. The conjunctio has to be there, but the conjunctio is the driving force in the Rosarium. In these pictures, one's not dealing with a conjunctio phenomenon so much, an awareness that that's there, but there's more emphasis on the spiritual dimension. A little like in that case I talked to you about with a patient who talked about creating a church. Yes?
I can't see from back here, but I'm curious about the frieze at the bottom of the stands. Is there any, what is that?
You see, at the bottom here, these are all pictures that are well known from antiquity, well known to art historians, not well known to me. And I haven't been able to get together yet with an art historian to help identify them. Yes?
I'm curious that he's standing on what looks like a fire and she's on a sphere of matter.
Yeah, she's on the moon, he's on the sun.
Okay.
It represents the sun and the moon. The pictures are all those aspects of life which are not directly engaged in the center. Here you have the king and the queen, their potential connection, but they're distant, you see. There is no link. They're not even linked by roses or crossed roses. There's no holy dove coming in as infusing their linkage, as in the rosarium. They're just there. And on the bottom there, you have a whole realm of violence and erotic attacking. But you see, it's at the bottom. It's not in the direct picture. There's pictures on the bottom there of a lot of nakedness. People on horses, maybe centaurs, a lot of violent behavior. It's that that is not meant to be center stage. Like Isis says, I did not attend to his advances. I did not even look at them. They're there, but they're background. This then becomes what we've seen as the first four pictures of the Splendor Solace. What happens now are seven more pictures which further elaborate those first four. Those first four, a lot can be said about them, a lot can be meditated with those pictures. Now we go through seven, which re-goes through that process in another way. Here, what you have is the alchemist going into mine a mountain. At the bottom here, once again, you have a scene that you see is left for the bottom half. That's the biblical scene of Esther and Haman and Ahasuerus, a scene of violence, a scene of duplicity, a scene of murder, all those impulses that always are involved in the incestuous field are rendered at the bottom. They're there, but they're not central. What's central is mining the ore. The ore for the alchemist is the central image in the Splendor Solace, and it represents those places where heaven and earth have met. In other words, it represents places in which there has been a real spiritual illumination. The mountains in alchemy are formed by virtue of the sun's rays heating the inside so hot that they bubble up and they burst out into mountainous forms. It's from those places the alchemists say the ore has to be mined. For example, that could be a psychosomatic symptom, which would be the ore to work with. Or it could represent an archetypal experience, a dream, a vision, or a synchronistic experience where matter and spirit unite. But the idea is to get the right ore and not pick the ore from the lunar crescent down there, which is where things are more dead in this case, and there are valleys and there isn't a rich, fertile vein to work on. So the beginning is getting the ore. In other words, the alchemist is now going to talk about having had some kind of illumination, whatever way you've gotten it, and now working with it, and what happens as a result of it. Now the work of its incarnation, okay? The work of it becoming an inner center. The picture that comes here now is a picture of a young man taking a branch off a tree and giving it to the two alchemists, and atop you have birds, with one with a white head. Below, in the scene below, the famous scene of Actaeon spying on Artemis is alluded to. You see, again, that mythical scene where he's torn to pieces by his own passions. But again, underneath, not the main focus. The main focus instead here is on this tree. It's interesting if you'll ever read Fabricius's comments on this versus Adam McLean's comments. Adam McLean is the occultist and Fabricius is the kind of Kleinian. For Fabricius, pulling off the branch has to do with masturbation. It has to do with a reawakening here of sexuality. For McLean, this tree represents the etheric body. It represents the fact that the alchemist here, because of the incarnation of the spirit, has now begun to experience a new body. That is, in fact, fact. That happens. When the spirit really does incarnate, one has a new body experience. The body becomes more subtle. The body becomes more capable of being a collector of information, becomes more capable of feeling out the environment in a very different way from before. Both people are probably right. There's a whole erotic necessity in that too. But basically it has to do with stage where now your body begins to change. This has to do with another stage that you go through, which is the death of the old king. Now what comes up here, you see the king in the background is drowning, and there's a new king being formed here, the sun. That means to say you then have to go through a phase in which you allow the death of your old values. Now mind you, this is not a simple matter. There has already been an illumination. The alchemist has already gotten hold of the ore. But what's talked about here is the fact that your old king will not just easily vanish. It may get pushed aside, but it's going to come back. It's the king that represents, you know, the ideals of your whole culture, of your whole collective, of your whole family. And it's going to come back, and it's going to tend to assert itself, and it has to be allowed to die, and that can be a terrible struggle. Once again, this could be a lot of clinical material can be brought to bear about this. Another picture of the soul ascending out of the muck, out of the marsh, starting to obtain a garment from an angel. This refers in the Splendor Solace. What this means now is the soul is starting to ascend out of its primeval places and getting a garment, meaning that now the product that you have within you is starting to be stable. To get the garment means to be stable. It means that it's now not going to just vanish. It's going to now have more of a solid form. Yeah?
What do you think of the one arm? It looks more skeletal.
No, it really is intended to be a white and a red. It's intended to mean that he's combining the lunar and the solar. Now comes another remarkable picture. You see, this is the state of dealing with psychotic process. This is the state of dealing with all your mistakes of the past. If you take this in an analytic situation, early on, the point was made that we get so involved in our interpretations and all that we actually create a great muck, make a great problem. Once you reach this stage, for example, what happens often is a lot comes out of the patient that has a tremendous fury and rage in it for a lot of the past mistakes, for a lot of the analyst's own psychotic elements that were involved in the process, for everything that went before that wasn't, quote, right, for all of our attempts that were necessary, but because of our ignorance, had a negative effect towards them. And the idea is to be able to cut that up, to suffer that state, and extract the head. It's extract the spirit and matter. Extract the positive out of it all. It has to do with extracting the value of the process as it's been kind of gone through and reflected upon in all of our previous madness. I mean that in terms of human relationships, in terms of analytic relationships. We get to a point where we can look back and realize we've been driven by horrible psychopathic forces. We look back and we can realize we've been driven by the worst of power drives. Where all along, we never knew it. And when we realize that, we become dismembered. But we have to not simply fall into a depression over that, but we have to extract the spirit, the essence, out of it all. And it leads to another state, another picture, which is a hermaphrodite, which is now a state of mind in which, As an individual, you are now capable of having a lunar and a solar grasp, of being capable of a lunar logic, of a logic that's based on metaphor, that's based on a kind of dim light of an imaginal process, as well as an approach that's discursive, reasoning, logical, spiritually illuminated from above. You have both. Not just one, but both. He's holding a mirror. Yes. Yes. That holds a reflection. It's your mirror. It's a cleansed mirror.
Is that supposed to be male and feminine, or just both?
That is male and feminine. That is male and female.
So what does the mirror represent?
All right. The mirror is an important symbol that goes back to magical practice. The art was called theurgia, T-H-U-R-G-I-A, which was the art of cleansing the mirror. It means the capacity to have a pure inner state that will reflect an essence of another person or oneself without being contaminated by the vices. When, for example, self-psychologists talk about mirroring and empathy, they're talking about a very double-edged thing. Mirroring can be a very psychopathic enterprise. How do you get a real clean mirror? This is talking about having a clean mirror, cleansed really of your ego needs. It's reaching that state. Notice now the outer borders are more gentle. The fighting, the passions have been subdued. We now have these levels of flowers. And it leads to this next phase, which has to do with the heating now of the soul, the kind of state of meditative heating until now the soul arises out of the body. That bird there is not alighting from above, but it's coming up from below. So it represents now the achieving of a state where through the capacity for heat, inner heating, the spirit rises up. In other words, these are all elements of your journey of incarnating a self. When that self is met first in a very strong, numinous archetypal form. Then come seven more examples. We can't go over all these. The process runs through seven more stages, which are like background stages. It's a transformation of a dragon now, which means fusion states again. See, it continually goes on. But it goes on amidst the commerce of life, as if you now see we're moving more towards the embodiment of this whole process into reality, into life. And life now becomes more around and enlivened. But in the background, there is this process still going on. The transformation process goes on, but one is not necessarily consciously attending to it. Seven of these. See all the affairs of court and all. This dragon is continually being transformed. This inner dragon means the transformation of the primary, our primeval processes, our processes within us which touch these waters of chaos, these waters of dissolution, yet these places of regeneration. And they're being continually worked with. Notice the vessel is stoppered, as it has been in the previous two. Again, a further differentiation. Warfare, the capacity to assimilate aggression, the capacity to deal with aggression. Yeah.
Any yeah. Special bird?
It's the alchemical bird Mercurius in a threefold form, but it's in its state of albedo. It's in its state of whitening. It's overcoming the death. It goes on now to the peacock's tail. This picture represents the eventual synthesis of mind and body. It represents that state where now a self begins to exist, which is neither material nor psychic, but both.
There was a peacock in the border of like second one. So
yes, right? Yes, but there it's on the border.
Right,
right.
But
now.
It's sort of a foreshadowing.
That's right. That's right. Now it's central to the process that integration has happened. Notice the outer life. It's peaceful. It's harmonious. You know, all there's a kind of a harmony comes into life at this point. Have you ever had a harmonious life? Nice, huh? Now there's harmony, genuine harmony. And now comes in the vessel, Luna, the feminine, is now emerging out of this. And now Sal, the king, is emerging out of this. Note something which is incredibly interesting here. She is standing on the sun. He is standing on the moon. Remarkable. The masculine has a feminine footing. The feminine has a masculine footing. And it goes on to now the final four pictures of the Splendor Solace. Look how wonderful it is. The sun above is black, but the sun underneath the earth is light. This can represent a creative depression. This represents a state where in consciousness your mind is darkened, but yet you know that it's because there's an inner illuminating process working. It means a state where you actively confront your depression because you know it has a much deeper, much larger root. This is a stage of children, which is always part of alchemy, the state of children. It's the state of play, a very advanced state. And in Winnicott's incredible manner, he talks about play as though it's an easy thing. He was always subtle that way, always talking about very deep things in very subtle ways. Play as an ingredient. Women washing. Someone asked me what was my attitude towards this case I dealt with where I had to be like the mother and had to have seemingly so much of a demand on me. It's like women washing. It's just work. Life goes on. That attitude, life goes on. And it leads to the last picture of the Splendor Solace, the 22nd picture. Notice how remarkable. The end is not so happy. He doesn't look so happy. There is an illumination, a really reigning illumination, perhaps at the end of life. And in the foreground is darkness, devastation, burned out. We're all burned out. Our lives have all been somewhat burned out. We'll never get over it. We've all done things or not done things that leave a terrible scar. And they're never going to be left and forgotten. They're always going to be with us. They should always be with us. And that's the kind of wisdom that the Splendor Solace contains. If you're going to have that kind of incarnated illumination, you're also going to carry a very heavy shadow. So that's it. Thank you.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.